Single houses, double houses, and villas were lined up in cramped, neat rows, which ran toward the tip of the peninsula.
"I see I've offended you," he said. "I intended to be charming, but I've been mocking instead. It's because my station is an awkward topic for me. I'm ill at ease with it."
I turned back to him, astonished that he'd been so free with his thoughts. I hadn't known a young man to display this kind of vulnerability.
"I'm not offended. I'm charmed, like you said."
"I thank you, then."
"No, I should be the one to thank you. The clumsiness in the drawing room, that was mine. And you..."
"I could claim I was trying to be gallant, but in truth, I wanted to impress you. I've been watching you. I was about to introduce myself when you whirled about and it rained punch."
I laughed, more startled than amused. Young men did not watch me.
"You created a brilliant spectacle," he was saying. "Don't you think?"
Regrettably, we were veering into the hazards of flirting. I'd always been feeble at it.
"Yes, I try." "And do you create these spectacles often?" he asked.
"I try."
"You've succeeded well. The ladies on the dance floor recoiled with such shock I thought a turban might sail off and injure someone."
But the injury would have been laid at your feet, not mine. I mean, it was you who claimed responsibility for the whole thing."
Where had that come from?
He bowed, conceding.
"We should return to the party," I told him, peeling his coat from my shoulders, wanting to end the banter on a high note, but worried, too, we might be missed.
"If you insist, but I would rather not share you. You're the loveliest lady I've met this season."
His words seemed gratuitous, and for an instant I didn't quite trust them. But why couldn't I be lovely to him? Perhaps the fates at the top of the stairs had changed their minds. Perhaps he'd looked past my plainness and glimpsed something deeper. Or perhaps I was not as plain as I thought.
"May I call on you?" he asked.
"You want to call on me?"
He reached for my hand and pulled it to his lips.
He kissed it, not removing his eyes from mine, pressing the heat and smoothness of his lips onto my skin. His face seemed strangely concentrated, and I felt the warmth from his mouth move up my arm into my chest.
Handful. The day Mama started sewing her story quilt, we were sitting out by the spirit tree doing handwork. We always did the trouble-free work there, hems, buttons, and trimmings, or the tiny stitches that strained your eyes in a poor-lit room. The minute the weather turned fair, we'd spread a quilt on the ground and go to town with our needles. Mrs. didn't like it. She said the garments would get soiled. Mama told her, "Well, I need the outdoor air to keep going, but I'll try and do without it." Right after that, Mama's quota fell off. Nobody was getting much of anything new to wear, so Mrs. said, "All right then, sew outside, but see to it my fabric stay clean." It was early in the springtime, and the tree buds were popping open while we sat there. Those days, I did a lot of fretting and fraying. I was watching Miss Sarah in society, how she wore her finery and going whichever way she pleased. She was wanting to get a husband soon and leave. The world was a wilting carpet stretched out for her, and it seemed like the doors had shut on me. And that's not even right. The doors never had opened in the first place. I was getting old enough to see they never would. Mrs. was still dragging us into the dining room for devotions, preaching, "Be content with your lot, for this is of the Lord." I wanted to say, "Take your lot and put it where the sun don't shine." The other thing was little Nina. She was Miss Sarah's own sister, more like a daughter to her. I loved Nina, too. You couldn't help it. But she took over Miss Sarah's heart. That's how it should be, but it left a hole in mine. That day by the tree, Me and Mama had the whole kit and come bundle of our sewing stuff lined up on the tree roots. Threads, needle bags, pin cushions, shears, and a small tin of beeswax we used to grease our needles. A wax needle would almost glide through the cloth by itself, and I got where I hated to sew without the smell of it. I had the brass thimble on my finger, finishing up a dressing table cover for Mrs. Bedchamber, embroidering it with some scuppernong vines going round the edges. Mama said I'd outshined her with my sewing. I didn't use a tracing wheel like her, and my darts lay perfect every time. Back 2 years when I turned 15, Mrs. said, "I'm making you our apprentice seamstress, Hetty. You ought to learn all you can and share in the work." I'd been learning from Mama since I could hold a needle, but I guess this made me official, and it spread some of the burden off Mama over to me. Mama had her wooden patch box beside her, plus a stack of red and brown quilt squares fresh cut. She rooted through the box and came up with a scrap of black cloth. I watched her cut three figures purely by eye. No hesitation, that's the trick. She pinned the shapes on a red square and started appliquing. She sat with her back rounded, her legs straight out, her hands moving like music against her chest. When we'd made our spirit tree, I'd sewed a pouch for each of us out of old bed ticking. I could see hers peeking out from her dress collar, plumped with little pieces of the tree. I reached up and gave mine a pat. Beside the tree charms, mine had Miss Sarah's button inside it. I said, "So what kind of quilt you making?" "This is a story quilt," she said, and that was the first time I heard of one. She said her mama made one, and her mama before her. All her kin in Africa, the Fon people, kept their history on a quilt. I left off my embroidery and studied the figures she was sewing. A man, a woman, and a little girl between them. They were joined at the hands. Who were they supposed to be? "When I get it all done, I tell you the story square by square." She grinned, showing the big space between her teeth. After she stitched on the three people, she free-cut a tiny quilt top with black triangles and sewed it at the girls' feet. She cut out little shackles and chains for their legs, then a host of stars that she sewed all around them. Some stars had tails of light, some lay on the ground. It was the story of the night her mama, my granny mama, got sold, and the stars fell. Mama worked in a rush, needing to get the story told, but the more she cut and stitched, the sadder her face turned. After a while, her fingers slowed down, and she put the quilt square away. She said, "This gonna take a while, I guess." Then she picked up a half-done quilt with a flower applique. It was milk white and rose pink. Something sure to sell. She worked on it lackluster. The sun guttered in the leaves over our heads, and I watched the shadows pass over her. For the sake of some gossip, I told her, "Miss Sarah met a boy at one of her parties, and he's all she wants to talk about." "I got somebody like that," she said. I looked at her like her head had fallen off. I set down the embroidery hoop, and the white dresser cover flopped in the dirt. "Well, who is he? Where'd you get him?" "Next ship to the market, I'll take you to see him. All I gonna say is, he a free black, and he one of a kind." I didn't like she'd been keeping things from me. I snapped at her, "And you gonna marry Mr. One of a Kind Free Black?" "No, I ain't. He already married." "Course he was." Mama waded through my peak, then said, "He come into some money and bought his own freedom. He cost a fortune, but his master have a gamble debt, so he only paid $500 for himself. And he still have money after that to buy a house at 20 Bull Street. It sit 3 blocks from where the governor live." "How'd he get all this money?" "Won it in the East Bay Street lottery." I laughed out loud. "That's what he told you? Well, I reckon this is the luckiest slave that ever lived." "It happened 10 years ago. Everybody know about it. He buy a ticket and his number come up. it happened. The lottery office was down the street from the market, near the docks. I passed it myself when Mama took me out to learn the shopping. There was always a mishmash of people getting tickets. Ship captains, city guard, white laborers, free blacks, slaves, mulattoes, and Creoles. There'd be 2-3 men in silk cravats with their carriages waiting. I said, "How come you don't buy a ticket? And waste a coin on some fancy chance?" For the last 5 years, every lick of strength Mama had left from sewing for Mrs. had gone toward her dollar bill collection. She'd been hired out steady since I was 11, but it wasn't on the sly anymore. And thank you, kind Jesus, for that. Her counterfeit badge and all that sneaking out she'd done for the better part of a year had put white hair on my head. I used to pull it out and show it to her. I'd say, "Look what you're doing to me." She'd say, "Here I is, saving up to buy us freedom, and you worrying about hair." When I was 13, Mrs. had finally given in and let Mama hire out. I don't know why. Maybe she got tired of saying the word no. Maybe it was the money she wanted. Mama could put $100 a year in Mrs.'s pocket. But I know this much. It didn't hurt when Mama made Mrs. a patchwork quilt for Christmas that year. It had a square for each of her children made from some remnant of theirs. Mama told her, "I know this ain't nothing much, but I sold you a memory quilt of your family so you can wrap up in it after they gone." Mrs. touched each square. "Why, this is from the dress Mary wore to her coming out. And this is Charles' baptism blanket. My goodness, this is Thomas's first riding shirt." Mama didn't waste a breath. She asked Mrs. right then to hire her out. A month later, she was hired legal to sew for a woman on Trad Street. Mama kept 20 cents on the dollar. The rest went to Mrs., but I knew Mama was selling underhand on the side. Frilled bonnets, quilt tops, candle wick bed covers, all sorts of wares that didn't call for a fitting. She had me count the money regular. It came to $190. I hated to tell her. Her money pot could hit the roof, but that didn't mean Mrs. would sell us, especially to ourselves. Thinking about all this, I said, "We so too good for Mrs. to let us go." "Well, if she refuse us, then our sewing gonna get real bad real fast." "What makes you think she wouldn't sell us to somebody else for spite?" Mama stopped working, and the fight seemed to almost leave her. She looked tired. "It's a chance we has to take, or else we gonna end up like Snow." Poor Snow. He died one night last summer. Fell over in the privy. Aunt Sister tied his jaw to keep his spirit from leaving, and he was laid out on a cooling board in the kitchen house for 2 days before they put him in a burial box. The man had spent his whole life carrying the Grimkes around town. Sawby took his place as the coachman, and they brought some new boy from their plantation to be the footman. His name was Goodis, and he had one lazy eye that looked sideways. He watched me so much with that eye, Mom would say, "That boy got his heart fixed on you." "I don't want him fixing his heart on me." "That's good," she'd said. "I can't buy nobody's freedom but mine and yours. You get a husband, and he on his own." I tied off a knot and moved the embroider hoop over, saying to myself, "I don't want a husband, and don't plan on ending up like Snow on a cooling board in the kitchen house either." "How much will it take to buy the both of us?" I asked. Mama ran the needle in the cloth. She said, "That's what you're gonna find out."
Sarah. I'd never been inclined to keep a diary until I met Burke Williams. I thought by writing down my feelings, I would seize control over them, perhaps even curb what Reverend Hall called the paroxysms of carnality. For what it's worth, charting one's passion in a small daybook kept hidden in a hatbox inside a wardrobe does not subdue passion in the least. 20 February, 1811. I had imagined romantic love to be a condition of sweet utopia, not an affliction. To think, a few weeks ago, I thought my starved mind would be my worst hardship. Now my heart has its own ordeal. Mr. Williams, you torment me. It's as if I've contracted a tropical fever. I cannot say whether I wish to be cured. My diary overflowed with this sort of purple outburst. 3 March. Mr. Williams, why do you not call? It's unfair that I must wait for you to act. Why must I, as a female, be at your disposal? Why can't I send a calling note to you? Who made up these unjust rules? Men, that's who. God devised women to be the minions. Well, I quite resent it. 9 March. A month has passed, and I see now what transpired between Mr. Williams and my naive self on the balcony was a farce. He has toyed with me shamelessly. I knew it even then. He is a fickle-hearted cad, and I would no sooner speak to him now than I would speak to the devil. When I was not engaged in aerating my feelings, or caring for little Nina, or fending off mother's attempts to draw me into my dutiful female tasks, I was foraging among the invitations and calling cards left on the desk by the front door. When Nina napped in the afternoon, I had Handful wheel the copper bathtub into my room and fill it with buckets of blistering water from the laundry. This copper tub was a modern wonder, imported from France by way of Virginia, and it was the talk of Charleston. It sat on noisy little wheels and traveled room to room like a portable dipping cart. You sat in it. You did not stand over a basin and pat water on yourself. No, you were quite immersed. To top it off, one side of the tub possessed a vent that could be opened to release the used water. Mother instructed the slaves to trundle the tub onto the piazza near the rail and discharge the bathwater over the side. The waterfalls splattering into the garden alerted neighbors the hygienic Grimkes had been bathing again. When a note with scratchy penmanship arrived at the house shortly before noon on the Ides of March, I swooped upon it before Mother. 15 March. Burke Williams compliments Sarah Grimke, requesting the pleasure of her company tomorrow night. If he can serve her in any way in the meantime, he would be honored. P.S. Please excuse the borrowed paper. I stood still for several moments, then placed the note back on the pile, thinking, why should anyone care if the paper is borrowed? And then the stupefaction wore off. Caught in a sudden swell of elation, I ascended the stairs to my room, where I danced about like some tipsy bird. I'd forgotten Handful and Nina were there. They'd spread the doll tea set on the floor beneath the window, and when I turned, I saw them staring at me, holding tiny cups of pretend tea in the air.
You must have heard from that boy, Handful said.
She was the only one who knew of his existence.
What boy? Nina asked,
and I was forced to tell her about Mr. Williams, too. At this moment, Mother would be dispatching an acceptance while singing Glory Be to God in the Highest. She would be so jubilant with alleluias, it would not occur to her to wonder at his credentials.
Will you get married like Thomas?
Nina asked. His wedding was 2.5 months away, and a reference point for everything.
I do believe I will, I told her, and the idea seemed altogether plausible.
I would not be a pressed flower in a book, after all. We'd expected Mr. Williams at 8 o'clock p.m., but at 10 past, he was still absent. Mother's neck was splotched red with patches of insult, and Father, who joined Mother and me in the drawing-room, held his watch in his hand. The three of us sat as if waiting for a funeral procession to pass. I feared he wouldn't appear at all, and if he did, that our visit would be cut short. By custom, the slave's curfew, 9 o'clock in the winter, 10 o'clock in the summer, cleared gentlemen callers from the drawing-rooms. When the city guard beat drums to summon the slaves off the streets, the suitors would rise en queue. He rapped on the front door at 1:15 the appointed hour.
When Tomfrey ushered him into the room, I lifted my fan, an extravagant nosegay of hen feathers, and my parents rose with cool civility and offered him the Duncan Fife chair that flanked the right side of the fireplace. I'd been relegated to the chair on the left, which meant we were separated by the fire screen and forced to crane our necks for a glimpse of one another. A pity. He looked more handsome than I remembered. His face had bronzed with sun, and his hair was longer, curling behind his ears. Detecting the scent of lime soap drifting from his direction, my insides convulsed involuntarily, a full-blown paroxysm of carnality. After the excuses and the trivialities, Father got right to the point.